welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. The 28th of June. Wow. Look at the time. It keeps going. Remember, the other day was Christmas. Wow. Anyhow, we had Professor Randy Masters on last night. Great show. And tonight we're going to have a lecture on some stuff that we build and then follow the UFO panel. So it's going to be really cool. We're going to have some fun here, so we'll go get this show on the road right now. Where are you, Dr. Bell? I want to hear you talking. Somewhere
now,
there.
Let's examine that for a second. Okay. If you take a pyramid and place it over a plant, the plant will grow 3 to 5 times faster than a plant with no pyramid energy on it. Now, you can take coffee or grapefruit juice or orange juice or anything that's got any acid to it, put a pyramid over it, and we'll neutralize it, shifting it to an alkaline state, which then demonstrates once again the negative ion effect, because all chemical change is ionization, and chemical change leads to cell reproduction and so on. So these are ways of demonstrating all of these effects of the pyramid. Now, I have flower shops. I have on videotape, which we'll probably show tomorrow, a flower shop that put pyramids in the ceiling. And as a result of spoilage, of that flower shop went to such a low amount that the lady increased her profits like 500%. She has a little flower shop about 4 times as big as this room.
She actually bought her son a Mack truck with a savings.
Full of dead roses, because roses will go bad in 3 or 4 days. They're not what she considers up to spec to sell to the public. But when she put these pyramids in, roses would last a week, 2 weeks in there. So that saving and right there, what she didn't sell in one day, passed on day after day. Then she took and found that you could take a bouquet that is really precious to you, hang it upside down in the pyramid, and all the sap would run out to the ends of the flowers, maintaining the color, and then the pyramid would allow the water to evaporate from the flower, and then you had a frozen bouquet, and you could take a bouquet, it would look fresh, and it would last 50 years. She'd spray it with clear lacquer. So these two discoveries caused her to make enough money to buy her son first a brand new 4-cylinder motorcycle, Honda, and then she bought her son a brand new Corvette Stingray. Now she bought him a $100,000 Mack truck. That's over a 5-year cost savings of pyramid energy in one installation. So, I mean, it gives you, on and on and on all day long in cost savings. That was before we even used negative ionization to enhance that. We got the banks, this goes on forever. Now, second thing is you can take sprouts. You can get, if you're going to grow a plant, any type of plant, normally it would take like 3 days to grow sprouts, like wheatgrass sprouts, things like that. We can grow them in 10 hours with a pyramid because it accelerates the growth. But actually, it's not accelerating the growth. It's allowing the growth to take place at its normal rate at which God intended it to do. But we've got our environment so screwed up, our water so screwed up, that everything is really going a little slow. Things should go faster than they normally do. But so we oftentimes will say the pyramid sped it up or increased it 3 times. It only allowed it to get closer to what it was supposed to in the first place. That's really what's happening. Now, there are 13 or 14 major vitamins known today and used and taken by us, but they all reduce down to 7 different basic vibrations. And these 7 different basic vibrations are the same 7 different energies and rays that are contained within the pyramid. And, of course, you can take pictures of them with brilliant photography. You take a green bean, for example, out of the soil that's mineral deficient. It has a very low aura. You put that green bean inside of a pyramid, it will charge the aura up great big, and then you put it in the pan and cook it, and you're able to restore a lot of the nutritional value back to it, because the pyramid does contain the life force vibrations. That was demonstrated in the apple experiment that I was telling you about. So, I mean, you can go on and on and on. There's 1,000 different things you can use the pyramid for around the house, let alone getting them on your body or even near your body. Yeah. Oh, 2 or 3 minutes. You know, we use them. In meat, for example, you can put a pyramid over the meat and it will make it very tender. And if you left it there for several days, it will turn into jerky. It's quite interesting, you know, what you can do there. Okay, now go ahead and change it. Okay, now, let's look at, I'm going to talk about now, for example, what a pyramid is. Okay? Hey, we are made up of oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon. That's what we are made up of. Mm-hmm. Now, in our bodies, the carbon atom is this shape. It's the octahedron. It looks like this. This is the natural shape of the carbon atom. This happens to be a piece of pure quartz. And this wasn't cut by man. This is the way it occurs in nature. This is one of God's shapes right here. It's a divine shape. The carbon atom in the body locks these three gases. As a matter of fact, it's true of the whole universe. It locks in these three gases, forming all matter as we know it. So the pyramid becomes the central shape of which all other shapes on the physical plane are derived from. What does change, however, is the density of the pyramid, or the carbon atom. There are different densities. For example, on one density level, carbon could be graphite. On another density level, it can be gold. Soft, malleable, but highly reflective. On another density, it becomes hard, it becomes diamond. And all of these precious elements, of which are highly carbon-based, of course, are attract themselves to man because they have energy, and man, of course, depending on what mode of consciousness he's in, expresses his lifestyle around the elements rather than letting the elements be expressed around him. He becomes victim to them. So, example is gold. Now, gold is one of the most misused elements in the world today. The Peruvians had the right idea when they used gold to line their temples with. When you go inside of a golden temple, you will experience a tremendous high in consciousness. Your consciousness is elevated many times what it normally would be if you weren't inside this. But what does man do? Man, who's typically coming out of the ground, takes the gold, buries it back in the ground, prints some money and says to his fellow man, this represents the money that's in the gold that's in the ground. The other guy accepts the money and says, I'll take that note. And then the guy, after he's handed off the note, goes and digs the gold out of the ground and lobs it to some other place. And this is what's been going on to our monetary systems for centuries on this planet. And it happened when the Spaniards came along and took the gold away from the Peruvians. Of course, there's a thing called karma that's attached to it. And the Spaniards didn't get home with the Peruvians' gold. It took the ship to the bottom of the sea when the Armada went down. So, the pyramid is a life force locking principle. The pyramid in your body holds your form in your body. If you didn't have pyramids inside of you, you'd be out there in an astral body or mental body or causal body or ethnic body, wherever level you wanted to work yourself to, but you wouldn't be on this plane here. So the pyramid holds you in. Now, that brings up what we call the pyramid principle. The pyramid principle is where matter is made flesh. Okay? Matter is made flesh. Now, I always had fun wearing the pyramid around Jesus Street because they think it's, any time a person is a freak, they're obsessed. Obsession is only caused by failure to serve God in the right way and also leads to satanic actions. And, of course, obsession means attachment. So the person making the accusation is actually the devil because they've made it up and they've inbred themselves into it. So this becomes a tool of Satan to the fanatics. That's what it's been called a lot, you know. And so this is what the understanding is, that the pyramid is the principle of matter made flesh, and people will confuse it with the Christ principle. The Christ principle is the principle whereby flesh is made spirit, higher principle. So the pyramid becomes a lower triad to a higher principle. That's all. The pyramid allows, when we're on the body to go into balance. When the body is brought to balance, then the spirit steps in clearly. This is a temple here. Okay? This is a temple. So what we're doing is we're trying to clean up our act, clean up our temple, so that something higher, a higher manifestation of our natures can occupy this temple long enough for us to express it and produce an action which gives us some kind of a trail of karma. This in conjunction with this higher aspect, and then that trail can connect with somebody else, and we can leave two trails behind us. That's what we're trying to do. And it's a little hard to do right now when you're bringing this dirty air and all this other stuff that we're doing, which is causing our hormone development to go regress rather than do progress. We're actually regressing now in our physical development at this point in time. Now, what we did at Paradigm was we had to build a pyramid that affected your head and your body. A cardboard pyramid on the head doesn't do anything. If you were subjecting yourself to, if in other words, if your body was so sensitive to shapes that if you could make a pyramid out of cardboard, then you would be affected by every shape to such a degree you'd have no control over yourself. So the shape had to be amplified to make it have a dynamic effect on the body. This was common sense. So what we did is we found that gold was pyramid shaped. Well, the first thing we found with the pyramid, we had to align it to the north. So if we had a gold on here, we didn't have to align to the north anymore, because the gold gave us an infinite number of directions how this pyramid would perform, which is exactly what gold does. Then we had to raise the power even more. So we began to work with different metals, dissimilar metals, the metals being active, metals being passive. So we started plating active and passive metals, using nickel as the passive metal, gold as the active, copper as the active, silver as an active metal, and we produced what's called the Orgone effect. So we were able to produce a category of four pyramids to date that produced four different distinct effects on the body. And this, of course, is how we began to do all this years and years ago. Now go ahead and change that. Okay, in 1930, WLW went on the air. Cincinnati, Ohio, they interviewed me one day. They had 500,000 watts of power. When they went on the air, 500,000 watts of power, they destroyed all the crops and vegetation within a 5-mile radius of the transmitter. Wasn't that neat? So the FCC stepped in and made them lower the power of the transmitter to 50,000 watts, what it is today, 50,000 watts. That's why no radio or TV station in this country has more than 50,000 watts of power. But that didn't solve the problem. It only solved the disastrous results of the problem. You still have the subtle influence continually bombarding you. Any place you can turn a TV on or hear a radio, you're getting the radiation from it. Well, we began to do experiments to alleviate this. We found that using shrimp, representing a single cell in the body, we put shrimp underneath the pyramid and some more away from the pyramid. In 6 to 8 weeks, the pyramid, the non-pyramid shrimp, receiving all the radiation throughout the planet at this point in time, they all float to the surface, and the ones under here would be still fresh. These would last a year. So we found that shrimp would last over a year inside a pyramid, and they'd only live 6 to 8 weeks outside. So that gave us an idea. This, of course, caused us to develop the big pyramids that we use over the bed. And it also caused us to build systems like this, because we were now coming in not from a component, but from a systems point of view. How many of you at night have ever gone to sleep, and just as you start to go to sleep, you find yourself going through some violent jerking sensation? Right? You jump. It feels like it feels kind of scary. Do you think that's a normal thing? Do you think that's natural? And what's happening is this. The physical body is here. Okay? The physical body at night goes to sleep. And here's what sleep really is. Sleep is created when the brain cannot electrically communicate with the body any longer. Okay? There's like a short circuit. And what causes the brain to short circuit is the buildup of lactic and uric acids by muscle movements and muscular movements during the day. As you move a muscle, it creates waste materials. These waste materials pollute the blood, and therefore robbing the blood of its ability to carry oxygen throughout the system. This causes the synapses and the nervous system to stop, and when this happens, it takes huge amounts of electricity to overcome all of these barriers. So the brain takes the consciousness takes the path of least resistance and says, I want to go somewhere. Remember, energy cannot be created or destroyed. The consciousness is definitely energy. So consciousness says, I'm going to leave the physical world and go to the astral or mental world, meaning that you're going to be green. Consciousness is going to go off and green and let the body regenerate itself. Now, while this takes place, the body, during dream state and rejuvenation, the body uses up 80% of its nutrients at night. Okay, your stress vitamins, all of that are burned up at night, 80% of the statistics, okay?
Whether you dream or not.
Whether you dream or not. Consciousness may blank out, you may not dream, but it's still, in fact, operating in a higher world, okay?
What about digestion? I thought digestion was inhibited. Or is that something else?
Digestion takes place at a slower rate. But the energy, the digestion is not where all of the nutrients are used up. Stress is the primary use where your nutrients are normally used up. Stress, of course, is brought on by being around other beings that aren't in harmony with God, and that contradiction requires, nutrition to overcome the barrier that's set up. So now, at night when you go to sleep, what happens is this. Okay, now,
you're physical, you go out of your, you rise, your etheric and your mental and astral bodies rise out 2 inches or more as a physical. And you start to float above yourself a little bit. And what happens is, we're trying to charge off Earth's magnetism, called anima mundi by the Tibetans. But this interference of the spurious radiation comes along and bombards the delicate vehicle, so it has to seek protection and it withdraws back into the physical at a violent rate, so you get the shaking sensation. That's why we built this big pyramid, because it alleviated that. Okay? Now, the next thing that happens is, during this time, when the person is inside the pyramid, just like the shrimp, the pyramid produces what we call the Faraday shielding effect, meaning that no radiation can penetrate that that's harmful to the body. And another example of that is taking one of our large pyramids out on a bright sunny day and putting it, you know, in the sun and climbing in it. And you won't get a sunburn, especially if you're a person that has. And I demonstrated that to Benny Lee and his husband in Hawaii. We took a couple of people, we took four people in the experiment, both were very white because they hadn't seen any sun. We put two in the pyramid, two outside the pyramid on a Hawaiian beach in the summertime when we were over there. About 4 hours later, we had a nice tan inside the pyramid, but the two people outside had severe overexposure, and they ended up having to go to bed for 2 days with sun exposure and just severe burns. People inside the pyramid had a nice tan. That's all that ever happened. So that shows you how the ultraviolet, which is harmful to the skin, is blocked by the pyramid. Radiation of another vibration, because remember, ultraviolet is up towards the color spectrum. But here we're talking about electromagnetic radiation. Now, oftentimes, the actual psychological experience of sleeping inside of a pyramid over the passage of time is total alignment to the magnetic, the true magnetic characteristics within the body. And that means that you'll require less sleep after you're identified with that pyramid. After a 90-day period, you'll require, the average person requires 25 to 35% less sleep. And you wake up in the morning refreshed and energized. Okay? I very much miss sleeping in a pyramid when I'm on the road. Okay?
Can you talk about like astral travel?
Yeah.
Where people would be able to move about outside of their body. What kind of protection could they afford that delicate body when they were actually moving around?
Okay. The astral body is not affected by this type of radiation. Okay? But the etheric body is. So the etheric body is always staying there, and the astral body will be free to travel.
So the etheric one is the one that's just hovering above it.
Uh-huh. Alright, the astral hovers too, but then the astral moves out when the astral travels, okay? Which I'll talk about in a minute.
Do we have one here?
Large pyramid?
Huh? Do
we have one here now? You can order it and I'll send it to you, okay? Let me tell you a little story about these large pyramids. We sell them for $60, $70, and $80, $10 a foot, okay? I don't carry any around with me, you know why? Because I don't make a dime on them when I sell them. But I sell them along with our product line because they're necessary. So I don't carry them with me. Yeah, order it and I'll send it to you in a special box. But we make no money on them. We really don't. It's very expensive to build the pyramids that we build for the bed, but they're necessary. We make enough money on the other things, and Pyridine is primarily a holistic movement within itself. It's a foundation, and it's here to educate. So we provide what is necessary. We make some money on some products, and we make no money on others. So the money, the ones we don't make money on, I can't afford to fly them around the country. I'll just take orders on them. Because people learn about them, they'll buy them. And then when I send it through the mail, then I don't lose anything. It's cheaper. Because I carry these things on the plane, I get hit with excess baggage all the time. But I can send you one. No problem. It takes a few weeks to get here. So now, you require, you know, less sleep when you sleep inside of one. But you have another thing. During the time that the 90-day period that you're breaking in sleeping inside of a pyramid, you're going to find yourself getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, fully energized, and then at 5 o'clock in the morning, being very tired again, as though you had no sleep. You'll find yourself going through a transition because the body is going through a strong detoxification. It produces a tremendous detoxifying effect on the body sleeping one of these things. Okay? And so the toxins will give you energy. A lot of people have all this nervous energy, but they can't channel it into anything. Well, if you take a Corillian aura or do a iridology or a barium x-ray, you'll probably find their lower intestine is full of poison. And it's giving them the energy because it's a form of energy, but it's a negative energy to the body. It just keeps them moving and they can't balance it. The body can't balance it, so it's out of balance, so it's sporadic. They're not crazy and everything. But they appear to be high energy. The current people are really low energy. They have to go through a purification and get their body energies balanced. Okay? So that's how we came about developing this unit here. Then we had a second thing that we developed, levels they've got here.
So what happens once they're detoxified? Then how much sleep?
They require less. What I'm saying is during the detoxifying period, the sleep will vary. Like some people, you put them in a pyramid, they'll require, they normally require, this has happened to me, I used to require like 6 hours sleep, okay?
Is that
long? Yeah. And then I'd get in the pyramid and I'd suddenly need 8 or 9 hours sleep. And the reason I needed more is because the pyramid would bring up the toxins. The body would then destroy the toxins, but it created, it took energy to do all that, so I'd get tired while I was sleeping. I got through that period. These are some of the things that you get. And this is often indicated when you go on a fast. When you first go on a fast, your energy level goes up for maybe 2 or 3, 4 days. And then suddenly it starts going back down.
Yeah.
So then you require a lot more sleep while you're going through the latter part of your fast. Okay? So the pyramid is producing that same condition on the body to give you a comparison. Okay, now you begin to understand it. Well, this was developed, this pyramid thing here was developed at NASA years ago. I wasn't the originator of this. This was an old idea that was brought about years and years ago of research. I was the one that pretty much brought it forward in the human consciousness. But, in the American public, because my job is to educate the American public. That's my primary job.
Well, that ran out pretty quick, so we'll do it over. Now, let's just keep continuing on here. Yes, we go. Yep, here's the next part. Away we go.
What's going to happen next?
You never know. This is actually the second UFO panel and Whole Life Expo that we've had in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And as many of you may or may not know, the Whole Life Expos are really one of the strongest voices of consciousness across this country. The originator of the Whole Life Expo lives in Los Angeles, and every year he does a show for 20 to 30,000 people who come to Los Angeles twice a year in the spring and the fall. He does one in New York City. He goes to San Diego, Seattle. This year, for the first time, he's going up to Oregon. He began, he also goes to Las Vegas, Nevada. And I understand he was inspirational in starting the one in San Francisco. So Paul Andrews is quite the pioneer in consciousness and has been responsible for really bringing the consciousness movement to thousands and thousands of people across the nation. When he decided to do one in the Santa Fe area 3 years ago, it was a big courageous step. And actually, we had a really pretty good attendance. I understand this is a real conscious area, and you can sort of get here and feel the vibe. How many of you live in Santa Fe? How many of you live in Albuquerque? How many of you live in another place close to here? Taos, any Taos people? I'm sure you all hear about the hum of the underground in Taos. You probably have some great stories for us later on. Well, you're living in a very, very hot area and a pretty conscious area for the country at large. And last year we had the expo in Albuquerque. We're back in Santa Fe this year. And despite the fact that we're in tents and we're in, you know, schoolroom, classrooms, it's really the gathering of the people that is the most significant and important thing. And so for those of you who go home tonight or you have friends who don't know about the expo, please spread the word. We have one more incredible day of workshops. The people that have come to be on this panel, I'm going to tell you a little bit about each one of them when I introduce them. And then what we're going to do is spend about 6 or 7 minutes where they're going to stand up and they're going to talk about themselves. And they're also going to talk about UFOs and their involvement with UFOs and how they see UFOs impacting the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the next millennium. Because make no mistake, we are definitely living in very exciting times. And they're even more exciting than falling through chairs when you sit down. Right? Anytime now, Linda could be lifted by a blue beam. You never know with this crowd. I'd like to kind of find out a few things about you, though, before we start. How many of you have actually seen a UFO? Raise your hand. Be proud. How many of you know people who have seen UFOs? Wow.
How many of you reported what you saw of those who had seen one?
Good question. There's not a lot of places to report them to. How many of you feel that you may have actually been on board a ship? How many of you feel like the experience might have been positive? How many of you feel like the experience might have been negative? Goodness gracious. That's amazing. How many of you have seen UFOs in your dream states? How many of you feel like that you have experienced what has been called lucid dreaming? How many of you feel like you've experienced earth changes in your dream states? How about, let's go through them, earthquakes, tidal waves. Wow, they were in Los Angeles. Hawaii and Los Angeles. What else have we got in the earth changes department? Volcanoes. Goodness. Pardon me? Floods? Ooh, hurricanes. That's a really good one. Any hurricanes in here? Well, there's some very good reasons for that, and a lot of them have to do with the fact that the extraterrestrial phenomena that seems to be impacting our planet at this time is not only, you know, occurring on a physical third-dimensional level, but it also appears to be happening on a little more multidimensional level. And a lot of us in our dream states and in our altered states of consciousness as we move from our normal beta brains into alpha and theta, which happens naturally when we sleep, or when we meditate at deep levels, it really makes us much more receptive to receiving some of those kinds of information. And you may pick them up simply because, you know, you're very good at out-of-body travel, or it may truly be that you're being contacted at those higher dimensional levels and information passed along to you. So, you know, once we get to the body of this and it comes my turn to speak, I'll speak a little more about that. But what I would like to do to begin is to introduce a very extraordinary group of people. All the people on this panel have been very deeply involved and instrumental in the UFO consciousness movement, and we're very honored to have them with us today. To my right, we have Virgil Armstrong. Virgil was an officer in the military, has been a major spokesman coming out of the military background for talking about what the government has not wanted people to know. And he's had the courage of his convictions enough to really get in front of the media and in a very grounded way share a lot of that over the last 10 or 15 years. We have Drew. And Drew has really just come public in the last few months. I haven't had a chance to sit in and listen to his workshop, but he was involved with the Philadelphia experiment. And for any of you who are, how many of you have heard of the Philadelphia experiment? How many of you don't have a clue what that is? Well, it's definitely a wild and crazy story, and it's so far out, it's like stranger than fiction. And so Drew's going to be someone you're probably going to want to get a chance to listen to sometime during the course of the weekend. To my left, we have the amazing Stanton Friedman, who has really, and I, you know, now he probably never described himself as amazing. Stanton is a physicist, and you can ask for a more third-dimensional, level-headed, practical guy, where I tend to be a little more multidimensional in my perception. Stanton really has his feet very firmly anchored on the ground. Stan has been important in the UFO movement in a lot of ways. He, along with Virgil, whenever you saw UFO shows in the last 10 years, it would be Stanton standing there with these documents that have been blacked in from the Freedom of Information Act saying, look at this document, can you believe this? How many of you have seen Stanton on television? Yeah, well, we'll give him a big hand when he gets up here, really. And on the end here, we have Linda Howe. And this is the first time I've had Linda on one of my panels. They've had me moderating these panels for about a year, year and a half. Linda is extraordinary in more ways than one. I mean, she is, like, I'm a commercial photographer. She's a documentary filmmaker. And she, again, level-headed, feet on the ground, very conscious, very research detail-oriented. And she sort of very innocently began to investigate from a documentary point of view the cattle mutilation phenomena. And it was sort of like opening Pandora's box. And here, 10, 15 years later, she's not only been responsible for being the inspiration for the television show Sightings, which, you know, the powers that be in Hollywood sort of went on without her, but she is the one who presented the information to Henry Winkler and Alma Daniels, and that began that whole television series. And she's also self-published two extraordinary books, An Alien Harvest, which came out about 10 years ago.
89.
Yeah, and it's hardback. And I mean, she had the chutzpah to do it herself, and she did a beautiful job with it. And she's just recently, I think she's been moving more and more into the multidimensional aspects, and she just came out with a new book about a year and a half ago.
Glimpses of Other Realities.
So you're going to really enjoy hearing from her. And last but not least, the wild and crazy Fred Bell. How many of you have met Fred? He's great. Fred is an Andromedan contactee. He's had his own experiences on board UFOs, just as I have. He also comes from a military background. He works a lot with crystals, and he also is an incredible composer. I heard some of his music, and I was like, you do this? He was like, oh, it all comes in from, you know, the Andromedans. So we have quite a gathering today, and what I'd like to do is perhaps begin with Linda and work our way down, and when it comes back, we'll come back to me. So would you like to begin?
Okay. Picking up where Tricia left off, I think a point I can make about why is it that I went the very difficult route of publishing two books rather than the normal New Yorker other route. And it is part of the problem that all of us face today in a kind of revolutionary time of simply trying to get to the fact that we're not alone in the universe. And that it is that William Morrow, for example, and some others were very interested in my experiences with the government, were intrigued by the phenomena, but told me point blank that there, under no circumstances, would they ever put any color photographs of these unusual animal deaths in a book for, quote-unquote, a mass market. And there were many other arguments with people in New York about what kind of content could go into a book that would be published. And I still can remember the day when I said to myself, what am I doing? Why am I arguing and going through agony with people who have never even been in a pasture and have never seen one of these animals, which, quite to the contrary, are not bloody, and it is very pristine, and that was the point of wanting to show a phenomena that is so unusual that in a color photograph that they are more pristine than they are any other word. And the fact that we are in a world right now that is driven by a very particular bias, and that the biases affect us at the media level, the political level, the social level, and several others. And the reason why a few of us, I think, have persisted, everyone has maybe their own particular reason, but I know in my case that as a journalist, since I graduated from Stanford in 68, and feeling that I should be, at least in constitutional terms, I should be able to investigate any subject especially one as important and having the long-range implications of contact with another intelligence, that we should be able to investigate and report without repression or bias of material. And it is a kind of, I suppose, deep-seated anger that has propelled me forward, because the deeper that I investigated the animal mutilation phenomenon, the more that I found people in law enforcement and even veterinarians who said that they would never speak on the record about their own experiences with huge orange glowing discs the size of football fields over pastures where these animals have been found, or beams of light coming down from something completely and totally silent in the pasture above, but a sheriff and a deputy knowing that the beam that was then lighting a pasture at least a half a mile in diameter with such intensity that they described the light as brighter than daylight, and that is an extraordinary light. Or people who have had the sounds of helicopters come down over the roofs of their house, in which dogs have thrown themselves against walls, leaving the walls completely scratched. And yet when they ran outside, they saw absolutely nothing in the sky directly above the house, but heard this gigantic roaring sound, which they could only put in the category of a helicopter. Or the people in law enforcement, ranchers, deputies, fellow journalists who have seen what they describe as dark helicopters over pastures where these animals have been found, but there's no sound. And a totally silent helicopter at 300 or 400 feet above a house, it may be a technology that military have today, and that may be controversial, but when this phenomenon began in the early 1960s, that kind of technology did not exist, and portable field lasers did not exist. And yet there is a doctor in Colorado who knows from his own examinations at the University of Colorado Medical Center at the beginning of approximately 1967 to 68 period, that he was looking at excisions in which there was cautery, and that something had happened to remove tissue in such an unusual way that he, as a medical doctor, was stunned and puzzled about the method. That is a fast and overview of what provoked me as a journalist in 1979 to begin looking into what I thought might be an environmental contamination story, and led me into these kinds of eyewitness testimonies that I've described and much more. And now in 1995, that first investigation has led me into the human abduction syndrome, the crop circle mystery, all facets of government knowledge and cover-up, of which there are many. And today in the old gym at 3 o'clock, I am going to present some material that I have never shared before concerning what it seems to me to be a pattern about what people today in the alleged inner sanctums are saying is the reason for a policy of silence about this phenomenon that may or may not be disinformation, but is part of a pattern of people who are beginning to leak more and more information, who seem to be frustrated with the system now as it exists concerning the phenomena that we're all dealing with. And so today I sit here before you as a documentary filmmaker and a television producer and writer who I have come up against all kinds of walls in terms of simply trying to investigate and report a story. And one of those was working in Hollywood with Paramount and Fox. It wasn't that they went ahead without me. It's that I did not want to go ahead with them. But at least television is beginning to try to report some of the stories that have been neglected for a long time. And my hope is that in the next year or two that we will begin to have more hard fact reporting, which I think if people around the world could be exposed to just some of the hard physical facts, like what Stanton will be talking about here shortly, that we could not continue much longer holding on to the idea that we are alone in the universe. So hopefully I'll see you at my lecture at 3, and tomorrow the workshop at 6. I will be going into even more detail, and I'm glad to be here with you in Santa Fe. Thanks.
Thank you, Linda.
I came to UFOs from a sort of weird direction. I was working as a then young nuclear physicist for General Electric on nuclear airplanes, 1958. And I was ordering books by mail, and I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping charges. And there was one, the Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Air Force Captain Edward Ruppelt, who had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. I was working on an Air Force-sponsored program. I figured he ought to know what he's talking about. It wasn't going to cost me anything. It was a hardcover book, shows you how times have changed, marked down from $2.95 to $1. So it was costing me nothing because the postage would have been that much. And if nothing else, it would be worth a laugh. And also I had some hopes that, gee, if these things are real and they're using nuclear power, it'll help our program. It didn't help our program, and I don't know whether they're using nuclear power. But from that one book to 15 more books to contacts with the Blue Book personnel to finding the largest Blue Book study ever done, Blue Book Special Report 14 at University of California Berkeley Library, which hadn't been mentioned in any of the other reports, I worked on my courage, started in 58. In 1967, I gave my first lecture. And since then, it's been 600 more colleges, 100 professional groups, all 50 states, 9 provinces, 4 other countries. I think I've answered 25,000 questions over the years. I've done hundreds of radio and television shows. I think it's fair to say that I have a pretty good opportunity, as good as anybody, to put my finger on the pulse of the continent, at least, besides having spoken overseas. And my role is primarily to replace mythology on either side of the UFO scene. That's why I did a workshop this morning about fraud in ufology, because there are believers who are fraudulent as well as non-believers who are fraudulent. My role is to replace myths with facts. And I've published 70 papers. I've got a brand new CD-ROM, interactive CD-ROM out that's got video and audio and everything else, trying to replace the crazy notions of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them, with reality. It is not true that you can't get here from there. It is not true that most people don't believe in UFOs. It is not true that educated scientists don't believe in UFOs. There's a whole bunch of these phony, baloney notions that are widely circulated. One of the problems I have when dealing with media people, I get calls quite often, I'm sure Linda does, from people who are talking about doing a documentary and who think that it'll be easy because there isn't any material anyway. And you have to work on them to say that your problem is just the reverse. There's far too much material. A lot of it's garbage, and trying to sort and sift isn't easy. You need a guide for the perplexed, which is the role we sometimes have to fill. And my goal in all of this is not only to replace the mythology and to make the study of UFOs respectable. After all, there have been 10 PhD theses done. There's room for 50. There are 5 large-scale scientific studies. There's room for 20. My goal, to summarize it at my ripe old age, I guess, I used to be one of the young squirts in the field, and now I'm probably, well, almost the oldest one up here, but my goal is to hope that my grandson's generation will behave in such a way that we create a planet that's suitable for intelligent life. I think we've done a lousy job so far, and that we will qualify for membership in the, or admission at least, to the cosmic kindergarten. Because one of the things that we tend to forget when we get involved in the minutiae, I'm the original investigator of Roswell, and admittedly I spend a lot of time dealing with phony baloney stories about Roswell and the television movie that made Jesse Marcel into something he wasn't and so forth. But part of the idea is to let people know that the world of our grandchildren will be the space world. I don't mean they'll be spaced out. But just as the New World became the place for exploitation, exploration, development, growth for old Europe over the last few hundred years, we're going to be hooked into the local neighborhood. We will recover asteroids. We will use the resources. We will explore. Man needs to explore, to grow. it's at our own peril that we forget that. It's nice to talk about saving money by cutting back on the space program, and I certainly have my complaints about NASA and its lack of leadership. But, like it or not, we will be hooked in to the local neighborhood. And that's one concept I try to get across in my lectures, that let's not talk about other galaxies. They're out there, lots of them. Let's not talk about going across our own galaxy. My college classmate, Carl Sagan, often talks about billions of stars and billions of galaxies. I'm a local guy, within 54 light years of here, which is just down the street, 54 light years. There are 1,000 stars. 46 of them are similar to the sun. If you're looking from where our visitors may be coming, that's the place to look. I was on a television show the other day in England, and a guy comes at me, "Hey, look how long it would take to come from thousands of light years away." And I said, "I don't know about you, but I don't care about thousands of light years away. I care about around the corner down the street." So we need to change our focus, but also, and this morning I talked about fraud in ufology, we also need to stand up and be counted and to point out the fraud when it occurs. Just because somebody says they believe in flying saucers doesn't mean that we need to believe everything they say. Ask for evidence. Don't settle for research by proclamation. It's inappropriate. It's unscientific. It's irrational. That's not what we need. We need carefully collected information. If you're going to talk about government documents, know something about government documents. If you're going to claim that somebody worked on saucers for the government, let's show some evidence for it. Don't settle for passing on stories. It's not good enough. The media people, some of whom are anti-UFOs, as some of you may have seen, just to give you an example, the article in Time magazine in mid-May by Leon Jaroff. He's the science editor of Time. He's also a fellow of the self-anointed Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, the SICCOPS. You can pronounce it any way you want. Their whole role is debunked him. They have never met a saucer they liked, if you will. And the story is just loaded with misinformation. The nasty, noisy negativists have been far more successful at passing on their baloney to the American audience than those of us who are concerned about facts and data and truth and science. We have to be aware of that. We're our own worst enemy if we repeat falsehoods. Makes it easy for these guys to attack us. Now, my own workshop is right after this at the dining hall, which is straight that way, and it'll be on crashed flying saucers, Majestic 12, the latest story, despite what you saw in the movie. I'm the original investigator, and there are some new developments, some exciting new developments, and that'll be this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. You know, this issue he was speaking about this.
This is the end of side one. Turn the cassette over now to side two to continue.